From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, bracing for yet another winter storm and possible spring flooding.
And this is going to be that heavier wet snow variety, so it'll be a little bit more water content in our snow, which is going to potentially further complicate the flooding problem later this spring.
From combat in Iraq to an office in Lansing, we talked to the retired Army officer whose new mission is getting benefits into the hands of Michigan vets.
Taking care of your troops is absolutely critical to being able to accomplish your mission.
And growing concern over dead zones and algae blooms on Lake Michigan.
There are communities that had to stop drinking their water in this past couple of years during those blooms because it is toxic.
We have those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. The Detroit automakers are moving into their fifth year of recovery after the disastrous collapse of 2009 when General Motors and Chrysler had to file for bankruptcy. Well, half a decade later, sales are brisk and auto loans are available. But is the future bright? This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, are there warning signs of another auto downturn? And if so, what needs to happen to stop it? And then later, how about adding smell to food ads? But first, are Michigan veterans getting what they deserve in terms of benefits and support? The Veterans Administration says when it comes to per capita federal spending on veterans, Michigan checks in at an average of just over $3,400 per vet. Now, the national average is over $4,800. So that places Michigan last in the nation at 50th out of the 50 states. What's the state doing about this? We're joined now by the director of Michigan's Veterans Affairs Agency, Jeff Barnes. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia, for having us. We really appreciate it.
Good to have you on. Jeff, if you can, will you start out by giving us a sense of what you see and you view as your mission at the Veterans Affairs Agency?
Well, our agency is just nearing 1 year old, and we are charged to serve as a central coordinating point for all things veteran in the state. And what that means is we realized that there are a lot of things that go on for veterans in the community. There's a sea of goodwill that exist. We estimate that there are about 450 local community organizations that have a veterans charge as part of their mission, and we have 14 state departments and agencies. So when we say central coordinating point, it means trying to pull all of those resources together, connect the dots so that it's easy for the vet to identify what they're eligible for and to connect with a service provider that can help them accomplish that.
So when we look at the dollars and cents of this question, why is it, do you think, that Michigan is 50th in the nation in terms of per capita spending on vets?
Well, I think it goes to a few things, and I always like to start by clarifying that that's the federal funds that come back
yes.
into the state. You know, I really think that it rolls around three different areas. The first is awareness, and I really feel that our veterans are not aware of what they're eligible for. And I always give the example that Vietnam-era veterans have had 53 changes of eligibility, expansions in eligibility, in the past 15 years.
Wow.
So if you're not looking back at the federal VA full-time, you probably aren't aware of what you actually qualify for. And it's been the case that week in and week out, we run into veterans that are either foregoing treatment or rationing meds that they're actually fully covered by the VA for. The second thing I would say is that vets haven't needed it to this point. You know, they may have come back. They were healthy. So, the last thing, and I think we've all been guilty of that, we delay that visit to the doctor. But they haven't needed it, or they came back and they got a job that had great benefits packages for them, and so they never looked back to the VA. And for many across the state, with our economic recession that we've experienced recently and some of the benefit reorganizations that occurred, veterans need to look back to the VA because they're probably eligible for something that maybe their private benefits no longer cover. And then the last thing I would say is that the system definitely needed some investment. From the federal VA, they've spent millions of dollars in overtime to be able to catch up with the backlog that they had. They've moved to some automated systems that allows us to, at the state end, to be able to enter the data in the claims much more efficiently and have a higher standard of quality assurance so that when we submit it to the VA, we're actually giving them a really good product. And as a result, we're seeing their backlogs decrease. And the average time that it takes for a veteran now to file a claim is about 150 days for a new claim. And that's down from 2 to 3 years that veterans experienced just a couple of years ago. So those are trends that are definitely headed in the right direction, and we feel as a state it's important that we continue that.
Jeff, give us a sense, if you will, how you interface with the VA, and I'm wondering, could there be more cooperation and better interagency communication, or is it pretty good?
Well, you know, that was one of the steps that led to creating the agency, is that we needed to have a better dialogue between our federal partners and then our state and local partners, because a lot of veteran activity doesn't always yield the outcomes that you want. It's about connecting and making meaningful outcomes to veterans that will change their quality of life. And so for us, our commitment and dialogue with the federal VA has been excellent over the past year. But as a state, prior to that, we probably left a little bit on the table as we didn't communicate very clearly with the VA, and we didn't understand their needs as well. And so I think it's a matter of perfect timing that the state has made the investment in the Veterans Affairs Agency. And we've got so many partners now at the local and the federal level that I think things are really coming together in a very positive fashion, and our vets are starting to see the difference.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with the director of Michigan's Veterans Affairs Agency, Jeff Barnes. Jeff, can you give us an idea, how much is your budget right now?
Well, our combined budget is a little over $60 million with our homes and our day-to-day operations that we have for outreach and communications.
Is that enough?
It is for now. I think what we have to do is really get the systems and processes in place and then do an evaluation on it. The incremental money that came in to set up the agency was about $9 million, and that allowed us to set up the staffing that we needed. It also allowed us to do some community pilots, in one in the Grand Rapids area, one in the Detroit area. We really use those as vehicles to explore what is working well with our collaboration and where are areas that we can improve. And so we wanted to really tackle the idea that we would provide no wrong door for a veteran. And when I say that, I mean it doesn't matter if a veteran first comes into contact with the Secretary of State's office or the Red Cross. We ought to be able to get them into a customer service process that will allow them to get the full wraparound of benefits that they've earned. And that's an area that we just have not done very well in the past, and that's why the investment moving forward was so critical. I really think, though, what we're seeing from those pilots is that there's a need for real-time customer service and a real central data point where veterans can go and their family members to connect with those services, identify what they could be, and understand how to connect with them. And so we have designed a web portal. We're going to be bringing a call center online. These are all things that we think will create a good customer service experience for our vets.
Because I've got to imagine there are some real generational differences in the vets that you're trying to serve.
There are. We run into a lot of things with our older veterans that they may not work on the Internet very often, and they may not have family members that will be able to find things. So there's a lot of face-to-face that's required. For our recent vets from the Gulf War and from post 9/11, most activities are done on the Internet. So from those veterans, we see that they want to find as many answers as they can on their own. And then when they start a discussion with someone, they want to be at the point where they can complete their claim. Mm. So it's a little less labor-intensive, but certainly we need to put the information out there for them.
I think it's important that everyone listening understands that you were in the military. You served nearly 10 years as an armored cavalry officer in the Army, and your overseas assignments included a tour in Korea, one in the Balkans, two in Iraq. And I'm wondering, how has that time that you spent in the Army influenced the way you think about the job you have right now?
Well, you know, the military is a great experience, and I really enjoyed the time that I had. It certainly went fast. I think there's a commitment that you have to soldiers that you learn as a leader. I was a commissioned officer in the United States Army, and taking care of your troops is absolutely critical to being able to accomplish your mission. But it creates a relationship that you have that many veterans talk about, and it's that sense of service and sense of meaningful contribution. And so as I left the military, like many veterans, you return back to a civilian life and you really long to find what that connection is. And I think it's served me well because some of the experiences I had during my own transition, my wife is a veteran also, our transition was bumpy in a few places. And I think that really gave me insight into what we should do as a state and how we can connect the dots, make it easier for the vet. And sometimes we often find that the solutions are there, but people aren't aware of them. And so that became extremely important, and I've just been very honored to have the privilege to be able to work on this and see the progress that we've made.
And to vets who might be listening or family members who are inherently, let's say, mistrustful of the government or tried to piece things together and got exasperated not being able to really get their arms around a nice, clean way to get to their benefits, what do you want to say to them?
Well, I would say, first of all, come to MichiganVeterans.com or connect with us through our customer service center, which we'll be rolling out here in about 45 days. It is an opportunity to look back and see what you're eligible for and then allow us to help you connect to that because we've got great opportunities out there for our vets. They've earned it, and we are going to do everything in our power to connect them to those.
And family members as well.
Absolutely. You know, most of the time it's our family members that drag us across the finish line, so that's extremely important.
Jeff Barnes, Director of Michigan's Veterans Affairs Agency, and we have put a direct link to the Veterans Affairs Agency website on the stateside page at michiganradio.org, and I'm gathering that's a very good place for vets and family members to start, right, Jeff?
Yes, it's michiganveterans.com, and certainly start there, and we'd love to come back in the future, Cynthia, as we roll out our new call center and share that with your listeners as well.
Jeff, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Still to come. Decades ago, Lake Erie was declared officially dead. Over time, the waters recovered, but now it appears Erie is in trouble again. We find out more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we've all kept rather busy this winter tracking the seemingly never-ending snowfall. And with nobody's friend the polar vortex hanging around us all winter, nothing's melted. So there's a sizable snowpack just waiting for the spring melt. And now we've got even more on the way. What are forecasters predicting in terms of river and road flooding this spring? We're joined now by Jim Masco. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, and he's based in Grand Rapids, where there's how much of a snowpack right now?
Well, we're sitting between 12 and 18 inches still.
And what do you think that would translate into liquid water?
Well, we have about 3 to 5 inches of liquid water in that snowpack still. So that's the equivalent of one of the two big rainfall events we had last April when we had the week of pretty big flooding here last spring.
Yeah, that's pretty sizable. And then here we are about to add to that snowpack. What can you tell us about this incoming storm as far as who's going to get hit hardest and when we might expect it and how much?
Yeah, the snow should start later this evening, and really what we're looking at is the folks that are closest to the Indiana border and then over from, say, Lansing down towards Detroit seem to have the best shot for, say, about 6 to 9 inches of snow. And as you move towards the Grand Rapids to, say, Muskegon area, we're looking at maybe 3 to 5 inches. And this is going to be that heavier wet snow variety because the storm system is coming up from the Gulf of Mexico. So it'll be a little bit more water content in our snow, which is going to potentially further complicate the flooding problem later this spring.
Oh, boy. And then also, are we going to see winds? Because that's always a problem on the highways when we get that blowing and drifting.
This, with the wetter nature of this snow, you'll have visibilities reduced when it comes to driving, but the drifting and blowing across the roads is not really expected with this storm.
Well, I just want you to know everybody around here just did that gag me sign when you told us we're going to see up to 10 inches possible here in this southeast Michigan corner. But here it is. We've got it. We've got to deal with it. And you know, looking to when inevitably spring comes and this stuff melts, let's start with road flooding and talk about that. Can the drainage systems handle all the snow that's going to melt?
Well, the issue with the drainage systems right now is that there are still a lot of locations where the snow piles along the roads are blocking the drainage system. So the water is having a little bit of a difficult time in working its way down into the drainage. So we're getting a little bit of road flooding and standing water on roads because of that. But this type of amount of rain, as long as we don't add significant amount of rain to it, the type of water that will melt this spring should be managed pretty well by most drainage systems across the state.
All right, let's talk about river flooding. And as you say, the Grand River certainly served up some unpleasant moments for Grand Rapids residents. Last April was at a record-breaking crest of 21.85 feet. So could that happen again this year?
We certainly are primed for a pretty active river flooding season this year, and part of that is that amount of water that we still have in the snow that has yet to melt. But the other part, too, is that we have a lot of ice on the river still, which this time of year is very, very unusual for us. And though we've had a little bit of that go away in the last couple days, the ice is kind of the wild card for us because if it breaks off pretty quickly, it could jam up along bridges and turns in the rivers and create what we call an ice jam, or essentially a dam on the river that could cause river flooding pretty quickly. And then as we go further into spring, the longer that ice and snow remains, if we add rain and quite a bit of rain on top of that, we could see some pretty significant flooding along the lines of potentially what we saw last year.
And what about southeast Michigan when you think we've got the Huron, the Raisin, Mill Creek and Dexter, we've got the Clinton, River Rouge. So what do you think spring might do along these rivers?
Pretty much the same thing. We're looking at a pretty wide snowpack with a lot of water on the ground for all of Michigan this year, including the Upper Peninsula. So, the southeast corner of the state is under the threat for river flooding, just like the southwest corner this year.
We've got, just thinking about this week, Jim, this weather is just, we had 50s yesterday, then we're going down way cold tomorrow, then we're back up again in the 30s and 40s by the end of the week. Does that do anything to make this all worse?
Well, actually, the fact that we're getting quite a bit of sunshine right now, our temperatures aren't terribly warm, where they're generally below 50, and then we're falling below freezing at night most nights. So that is actually helping us to slowly melt the snow a little bit. So if we can continue this pattern for a couple more weeks and slowly melt away the snow, we will add to our rivers, but we'll actually reduce the risk a little bit of river flooding if the melt continues slowly.
Is there anything individuals can do to prepare themselves or to help this minimize this flooding?
Really, it's just the number one thing is to be prepared and have a plan of action and basically pay attention to the local news, your local radio station, the National Weather Service for updated information on the potential for flooding, and also to pay attention to what the weather's doing. If we have a prolonged period of temperatures above 50 degrees, 2 or 3, 4 days in a row, we get a lot of rainfall, and you live near a river, that's really kind of the ingredients we're looking at this year for flooding. So have that awareness of the weather. Be prepared to move things to higher ground. And then, of course, be ready to get out of your home if you live in a vulnerable place. before the flooding occurs.
It also strikes me that it wouldn't be a bad idea to get out there with your shovel and make sure that your storm drain cover is nice and clear so it it can do its job.
Yeah, anything folks can do to help the drainage system become clearer is a help to drain that water the way it's designed to.
National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Masco, we will not hold you responsible for what's coming around the corner overnight into tomorrow, but we will certainly hope for repeats of yesterday's 50 degrees because everybody was in a much better mood.
Most definitely, and we're hoping everyone has a nice flood-free spring.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Thank you.
If you lived in Michigan in the 60s and 70s, you'll no doubt remember Lake Erie was really on the critical list. In fact, it was once declared dead. But the lake got back on the road to health and recovery until the mid-1990s. And that's when the lake started showing signs of distress again with large algae blooms and dead zones. And now comes a report from an international agency that keeps a close eye on the health of the Great Lakes, and it's a clarion call to action. The report was headed by Don Scavia, director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan. Hi, Don. Very good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, you were the leader of this report, so we certainly have the right person to answer this question. The report was done for the Eco4 Lake Erie Project, and what did you find about Lake Erie?
Well, as you said in the introduction, the lake did a turnaround in the mid-1990s. We made great progress, in the 70s and 80s, mostly by controlling point sources. That's phosphorus loads that come from sewage treatment plants and from municipal discharges. And things were getting better. And in the mid-1990s, things started getting worse again. And that's what we focused on in this Eco4 report, mostly looking at the Central Basin dead zone, which is now as big as it has ever been.
Really? As big as it's been even back in the bad days?
Yes, absolutely. And that was the concern for us because we knew that, in fact, the studies in the Eco4 project look specifically at the impacts on fish, which is, of course, what we're really concerned about in Lake Erie. And what we're finding is that there's something called the, ready for this, thermo-oxy squeeze happening to the fish. And what that means is...
And in English?
Yes, in English. What it means is because of the loss of oxygen in the bottom water, it's forcing the fish that prefer to be there, like yellow perch and others, forcing them higher up into the water column where the water is warmer. And it's not as good for them. And so they're being squeezed, oxygen squeezed from the bottom and thermal squeezed from the top, and they're being forced into some very narrow bands, which doesn't bode well for them in the long term.
And if you can, Don, give us just a sense and an understanding of chemically what's happening in Lake Erie to cause the algae blooms and these hypoxic, oxygen-deprived dead zones.
Yeah, so let me start with from the dead zone. The reason why the oxygen goes away is because algae that grow into the surface water sink to the bottom and they decompose. And the bacteria that decompose them use up the oxygen. And because the lake is sort of stratified with warm water sitting on cold water, the oxygen from the atmosphere can't get down there. So that's why the oxygen depletes during the year.
Okay.
The algae themselves are stimulated by phosphorus coming off of the land and going into the lake. And so what we've seen since the mid-1990s is there's been a dramatic increase in a particular kind of phosphorus being delivered to the lake. It's called dissolved reactive phosphorus, and it's the kind of phosphorus that is most easily used by the algae. The interesting thing is that between the 1980s and now, the total amount of phosphorus going into the lake hasn't changed very much. It's been below the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement standard target, but the fraction of that total phosphorus that is in this very, very available form has gone up tremendously. It's increased by a factor of 2 or 3.
Of this dissolved reactive phosphorus.
That's right. And that's what stimulated the increase, the toxic blooms in the Western Basin and algae production in general, and then increasing the size of the dead zone.
So is this DRP coming from industry or from farms?
The DRP is coming from agriculture.
So what can be done about that? Can it be legislated, or can it, and we're talking about both the U.S. and Canadian sides of the border. Let's talk about agriculture. What can be done to get farmers to adopt practices that are more lake-friendly?
Well, so on the U.S. side, the U.S. Farm Bill, which actually President Obama just signed in East Lansing,
yes,
just a couple weeks ago. The Farm Bill is the mechanism that we use to incentivize and pay farmers in a voluntary sense to do conservation programs and conservation measures, best management practices on the land to prevent phosphorus from getting into the lake. There's a couple of issues associated with that. One is most of the best management practices that have been developed over the last several decades have been designed to control erosion, and that is to keep the particulate phosphorus, the phosphorus that goes with the sediment, from going off the land and going into the lake.
Okay.
They don't address this dissolved form. This is sort of a new phenomenon, and a new set of best management practices have to be developed for that application. So that's one issue. The second is there's a general feeling in the community that there is not enough funding going into the conservation programs, that there just needs to be, if we want to continue to rely on voluntary incentive-based programs, there has to be more funding going into those programs, and they have to be targeted to specific places within the watershed where we have the hot spots of phosphorus loading, and not just generally distributed across the landscape.
Federal dollars?
It's federal dollars, that's right.
Help us understand why Lake Erie is so susceptible to this. We don't hear this as much with the other lakes.
Yeah, so Lake Erie is kind of special physically. This bottom layer, this cold water that sits, relatively cold water that sits at the bottom, that's isolated from the top, is, first of all, it doesn't exist in the Western Basin because the Western Basin is really well mixed up. In the Central Basin, it's deep enough so that it stratifies, but it's shallow enough so that bottom layer is relatively thin. And so it's easy to deplete the oxygen.
Mm.
In the eastern basin of Lake Erie, it's quite deep, and it doesn't have this problem. And in most of the parts of the Great Lakes proper, the lakes are just so deep that you just can't deplete the oxygen. However, Green Bay has the same problem. Parts of Saginaw Bay have this problem as well, because they're also deep enough to stratify but shallow enough to cause this problem.
If you were doing, I dare say, I'll call it a doomsday clock, with midnight being the lake is dead, as bad as it was when I remember the burning water in the 60s and concerns by people who had cottages and people who enjoyed it and lived around Lake Erie. So we had this officially dead lake. So that's midnight doomsday. Where are we on that clock?
Well, it's hard to put it in that context, but I mean, it's certainly well past noon. There's no question about that. The interesting difference is, back in the day when Lake Erie was declared dead, mm-hmm. The rivers were catching on fire. It was very visible. And up until 2010, 2011, we knew we had this problem with the low oxygen in the bottom waters and the potential impacts on fish, but you can't see that. You can't see low oxygen in the bottom of the water, so it was hard to get a lot of attention. In 2011, when we had the massive toxic algae blooms in the Western Basin and extending all the way to Cleveland, it was a bit reminiscent of rivers on fire, because you could see this at the surface, and it got a lot more attention. And that's what actually drew the International Joint Commission and now the new Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement to really start to focus on taking new action. And I do want to point to the new International Joint Commission report that also came out last week, where they are actually calling for the states of Michigan and Ohio to declare the western basin of Lake Erie impaired under the Clean Water Act, which would actually start to bring in other agencies and other mechanisms that go beyond the Farm Bill and USDA, and that may be sort of an important new step.
And do you expect equal cooperation on the Canadian side of the border?
One of the things about the Great Lakes region is that cooperation exists, and I think everyone's interested in resolving this problem. We did it once before, and I think we need to do it again, and I think the cooperation is there.
And what can individuals who really care about the lake and the health of the lake, what can people do?
Well, on the sort of the personal local front, I mean, there is an important push to ban phosphorus in lawn fertilizers, which is a good thing. In most places, you don't need that phosphorus in the fertilizer. So that's one thing. Non-point source runoff from our urban environments is important. Those are all important steps, all things that need to be done, but they're all pretty small compared to the load income from agriculture. So I think what individuals can do is talk to their representatives in Congress and in their state legislatures to find better and more important and new ways of dealing with the agricultural part of the problem.
And if we don't?
If we don't, we are going to continue to see large dead zones. It will likely impact the fish, and the toxic blooms may continue, which has very serious human health impacts. There are communities that had to stop drinking their water in this past couple of years during those blooms because it is toxic.
Don Scavia is the director of the U of M's Graham Sustainability Institute. It is always a pleasure to talk with you and get your perspectives. Thanks so much, Don.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. The Detroit automakers are moving into their fifth year of recovery from the disastrous collapse of 2009, when GM and Chrysler were forced to file for bankruptcy and Ford had to mortgage itself to the hilt to avoid the same fate. Sales are brisk, auto loans are available, and the future is bright. Or is it? Are there warning signs of another auto downturn? And if so, can Michigan protect itself from getting slammed as hard as it did in the last collapse? Bridge magazine writer Rick Hagelin wrote about this in a recent piece for Bridge. Welcome back, Rick.
Good to be with you, Cindy.
Good to have you back. And we're joined here by Kristen Jicek from the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor. So good to have you with us, Kristen. Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
Rick, what were you seeing that led you to ask the question, is Michigan in another auto bubble?
Well, first of all, it's a very cyclical industry, as we all know. We are in the fifth year of an auto recovery from 2009 when, as you mentioned, Chrysler and General Motors were in bankruptcy and Ford was struggling as well. And so I just decided to kind of take a look and see what some of the trends were that were going on in the industry and whether there were some warning signs about whether this five-year recovery was getting ready to slow down a bit or maybe even bigger trouble signs ahead. Things have been going along pretty well. Sales have been good. Profits have been outstanding. But some of the warning signs that we've seen had to do with rising inventories on dealer lots. It looks like sales are slowing down a bit. Whether that's just weather or whether there's something larger going on is being debated at the moment. But as I said earlier, it is a cyclical industry, and thought maybe it would be a good time to take a look and see what the condition of the industry was.
And we're looking at something along the line. I think I saw in your piece, Rick, somewhere around more than 100 days of inventory for the Detroit 3, where a 60-day supply is considered normal. But again, the miserable winter has certainly kept people from going out. It has been terrible really across much of the nation. And we also knew that people held on to their cars during the Great Recession. They just couldn't afford to buy new ones. So there was a huge pent-up demand once things picked up. And shouldn't we expect that to not be sustainable?
Well, the average car is over 11 years old on the road, and that's not one owner, but the average vehicle on the road is over 11 years old. It's partly a consequence of building better cars, that they last longer, but it's also an indication of the economic fundamentals underneath. We really don't think there should be sales as high as they have been. Generally, we don't see sales growth in the positive range unless we have GDP growth above 3%. We have a 60-year trend, data trend, that's been broken in this five-year recovery. We've got GDP kind of slugging along and double-digit sales increases in autos. We also don't see automotive sales somewhere above 15 million unless we have unemployment below 6%. Huh. Unemployment's in 7%, a little bit over 8 here in Michigan. So these underlying fundamentals of the economy have been not as strong as they need to be to support the level of sales we've seen.
And something that you looked at in your piece, Rick, was the fact that there seems to be some signs that auto companies are sliding towards using sales incentives again. And I thought after the near-death experiences, didn't we hear that they had seen the error of their ways in relying on those deals and incentives, and they weren't going to do that? Are they sliding back into bad old habits, Rick?
You know, it seems that perhaps they are to some degree. They're really trying to avoid it and keep price discipline. But as these inventories build up, you know, they've got to do one of two things. They've either got to move the metal, so to speak, by discounting, or they have to reduce production. And they don't really want to reduce production. So they are starting to rely on some increased sales incentives. And I just, in fact, last night I happened to notice a couple of ads on TV from both foreign and domestic car makers where they were offering 0% financing again for 60 months. And 0% financing was one thing that helped really get the auto companies into trouble from a profit standpoint and that they've been trying to avoid, but it looks like it may be back at least to some degree.
What do you think of that, Kristen?
Well, you know, we've looked at this price discipline a little bit. And when you look at, you know, we're asked all the time, is the auto industry really back? And if you look at it, product is really good and almost indistinguishable from the competitors. We've got very high quality, very good products in the showrooms. Productivity is at an all-time high, 46% higher than it was in 2000. So employment productivity has been, labor productivity is very high. Profitability, like Rick said, they're making money. They've made tremendous investments also in North America and especially in this region, in the Great Lakes. Production has gotten almost up to where it was.
Okay.
Sales in terms of units are not back to where they were in 2006 or 7. Sales in terms of dollar volume of the market has fully recovered. And that's because the price per unit has been higher.
Okay.
They've had that great discipline on incentives, so each vehicle brings in more money and more profit. And then employment. Employment still lags tremendously behind all of the other recovery factors. We're not back to the employment that we were before the crisis.
If you just joined us, that was Kristen Jicek from the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, and she's joined by Bridge magazine writer Rick Haglund, who wrote about the question in a recent piece for Bridge, is Michigan in another auto bubble? And let's talk some more about the actual auto jobs we have here in Michigan. First, do we have a sense how many, what percentage of jobs in Michigan are auto-related?
It's almost a quarter of what the U.S. automotive employment is. We used to be closer to a third of U.S. automotive employment here in Michigan in 2000.
Rick, your piece pointed out the shift in the types of auto jobs that are available in Michigan. Can you talk more about that for us?
There was a Chicago Federal Reserve study that I used in the story that indicated that about half of the jobs, the auto jobs in Michigan, are on the salary side. Some of that has to do with the fact that, you know, the percentage of hourly jobs has gone down in Michigan, so it's more evened out that percentage. But you know, as Kristen has talked about, the industry's gotten much more productive, so they can build many more cars with the same number of workers they had about 10 years ago. So the more intellectual type jobs in the industry, engineering, design, sales, and marketing, seem to be where it's at right now.
And the things that really we would call white collar, and the things that need that stronger education base for Michiganders to be able to get those jobs. Is this, hearkening back to Mexico, is this because we're seeing many of those production jobs go to Mexico while the R&D is staying here in Michigan, both for automakers and for the suppliers?
Well, Michigan is the center for over 80% of automotive R&D spending in the United States. So we have long been the hub for automotive research and development. There's a lot of changes coming to cars. I know, listeners who may have recently bought a new car probably had a lot more to get used to this time with all the technology that's been put into vehicles in powertrain and propulsion, in electronics and software in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that requires more salaried workers, more engineering, more technicians. So we do see that same trend that the we're about half and half of automotive production and automotive R&D and engineering and salaried workers.
Rick, in your piece in Bridge, you pointed out the fact that Governor Snyder has said Michigan needs to diversify, but then last fall certainly seemed to downplay that and announced that he plans to double down on auto industry investments. So Is this short-sighted? Is he trying to have it all ways?
Well, I think what, in some sense, what he's doing is what you know, many elected officials do when they're running for re-election, is they're trying to accentuate the positive, and the positive for Michigan has been manufacturing in general and the auto industry specifically. Manufacturing has produced the biggest job segment growth in the state's economy over the past few years. This has really been a manufacturing-led growth, and I think the governor is trying to ride that horse as long as it'll go, and sees some opportunity there, primarily on this salary side of the industry, the R&D and the growth that may be needed to deal with developments in the auto industry, like driverless cars and higher gas mileage. So you'll have the need for more research into lighter materials and more efficient powertrains, that sort of thing. So I think he's looking at what's going well in Michigan right now and trying to accentuate it.
Kristen, what do you see as the most important things for the governor's car czar, Nigel Francis, to do now as you look onto the horizon for the auto industry and for Michigan? What decisions and what direction should be taken now for Michigan?
Well, I think we have two really big issues in front of us. One is we do have a lot of the R&D infrastructure here in Michigan, as I mentioned before. But things are changing, as Rick mentioned. So we're moving to more automated driving. People have seen the Google car probably that drives around without somebody behind the wheel. There's a danger that those sorts of developments take place someplace other than Michigan, and we end up making the dumb box that other people put the intelligence into. And so the state of Michigan has set out to capture all of that new part of the industry. So as Rick mentioned, autonomous and connected vehicles, powertrain and propulsion, manufacturing systems and supply chain, and lightweight and multi-material vehicles are the real focus that they're going after for attracting businesses. The other side of it is making sure that we have the right talent here to make that attractive for those businesses that are here, as well as the ones we're trying to attract.
And that gets right back into education.
Yep.
It's so amazing how you see these lacing together, and as here we are talking about this, and then we get back to that, what kind of education are Michigan kids getting? And then hanging on to these graduates when they leave. So the idea is trying to pull in as much new business as we can to keep these graduates here in Michigan.
And attract others to come here.
Attract others. Interesting conversation based on a piece in Bridge Magazine by my guest Rick Hagland. The piece is Michigan in Another Auto Bubble. And he was joined by Kristen Gicek with the Center for Automotive Research. Thank you so much to both of you for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
What if smell was incorporated into the commercials for the cars that we were just talking about? We certainly know scent unlocks a wide range of emotions and memories. Perfume advertisers totally get this. They've been tapping into it for a long time. Think of the scratch and sniff spots on perfume ads and magazines. Well, while using smell in a car commercial might be a little too much, a University of Michigan marketing professor decided to see if using smell would be effective in food advertisements. Aradhana Krishna is an expert in sensory marketing, and she joins us now from Singapore, where she is doing research. Very good to have you with us on Stateside.
Oh, I'm very happy to be on Stateside, Cindy.
So tell us about your study. What was it you were trying to prove?
So one thing I noticed, Cindy, was that food ads don't typically mention smell. And I started thinking a little bit about that, and I realized that unlike smell ads, so ads for perfumes or ads for deodorants, which can have scratch and sniff ads, it's difficult for food ads to do the same. So you brought up scratch and sniff ads earlier. The difficulty is it's not easy to replicate the smells of foods. So then I started thinking that, in fact, smell is such an essential component of taste. We know that smell, to a large extent, determines what the taste is. Then how is it that smell is not being utilized in food ads? So again, the thing is, it can't be incorporated through scratch and sniff ads. And I started thinking, but what about olfactory imagery?
When you say, Aradhana, when you say olfactory imagery, what does that exactly mean?
Okay, so when we say olfactory imagery, we mean that you think of visual imagery. So visual imagery is common. So can you imagine a horse, or can you imagine the picture of a horse in your mind? So in your mind, can you imagine a horse or a sunset or a blue car? And people are easily able to do that. So there's never been a question about whether people can visually imagine objects. But there was within the academic literature, there was this doubt about whether olfactory imagery exists. And so can people imagine the smell of popcorn? Can people imagine the smell of their mom or of their husband or their loved one? So can they just imagine the smell? So that's what we were going after. So we started studying, so can imagining smelling food result in the same sort of desire for food as actually smelling the food can do?
And that certainly would have big consequences for the food advertising industry.
That can have very big consequences for the food advertising industry. And, you know, and since we are at the University of Michigan and we wanted to do, you know, rigorous work, we wanted to see how exactly we should measure this desire for food. So we did it in two different ways. So one was a more physiological non-conscious measure, which is through salivation. So we were actually measuring how much people salivate after doing this, engaging in this olfactory imagery versus not engaging in this olfactory imagery. And then the second thing was a self-reported desire for food. And a third way we measured it was actual a consumption of cookies itself.
All right. So what did you find?
So our results were very interesting. So, for example, in the salivation studies, we found that when people are asked to imagine the scent, salivation goes up. So let's say there are two sets of subjects, so two sets of people who are in this experiment. And one set of people are not asked to imagine scent. The second set of subjects are indeed asked to imagine the scent, the smell of the cookie. And both are given access to the picture. We find that salivation is much higher. So they're drooling over that cookie much more if they're asked to imagine the scent. And we were actually measuring the salivation in grams. And we were saying, you know, like, how much is it going up? And it was going up by quite a lot. It was quite different between people who were asked to imagine the scent versus not.
Aradhana, what do you think your research could tell advertisers? As far as what do you think would be the elements of an effective food advertisement? If I want to sell my hamburger to the public and get everybody to come buy my hamburger, what would be the elements then of an effective ad?
So what the research shows is, so firstly, you do need access to the picture. So what we would say is, in print ads, for example, if people do somehow encourage the consumer, the reader, to imagine the smell of the food, it would go a long way in increasing the desire for that food. So it will make people want it and go and buy it to a much larger extent. Versus if somehow the ad is designed in such a way that nobody's even thinking about smell. So if somehow you can make people try to imagine the smell, it'll really help you. But if it's a radio ad where there's no picture, it would only be, so if asking people to imagine smell would be useful for people who intrinsically are very good at imaging. So it could work for those people, but not for everybody.
It certainly seems when I'm thinking of advertisements, you think of they're summoning the taste of the food rather than
right.
the smell. So you're giving advertisers a new tool, if you will.
Well, I hope so.
Interesting research. University of Michigan marketing professor Aradhana Krishna, expert in sensory marketing, and her study finds invoking the imagined smells of a food can trigger quite an increased desire for that food. Thank you so much for talking with us, Aradhana. It was fascinating research.
Thank you, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.